I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
The wind was a problem in more ways than one in Las Vegas this past week, and more on that video later on in the show. But first and foremost, everyone, welcome in to the program. Charlie Arnold here. Hope you all had a fantastic weekend. And we have a big top story on our hands, one that I am very, very excited to hear about. Now, the University of Florida might be known as the swamp, but let me tell you, this is one swamp that has been drained of all of the woke nonsense at this point. UF just shut down the office of the chief diversity officer, axed every single DEI employee, and has put an end to all DEI-focused contracts with outside vendors. Can you say winning? Come to think of it, now that UF is entirely back to focusing on meritocracy, is it safe to say Florida might be a better option to attend college than, let's say, I don't know, Harvard? It's a state school versus an Ivy League. But while Harvard used to mean this.
You got into Harvard Law?
What, like it's hard?
It has now turned into a cesspool of anti-Semitism, foolish pronouns, and Taylor Swift-centric courses run by people in many instances who were hired because of their minority status. And it has donors pooling their funds. Can't say I'm surprised. Meanwhile, the University of Florida is not only doing away with DEI, they are reallocating the $5 million in funds originally meant for DEI into a faculty recruitment fund to bring on board people who actually deserve to be there. And they deserve to be there on the basis of merit and not their skin color or minority status. So would you rather, this is probably a question to ponder, making this decision even more easy for one to decide where they would want to attend college. Would you rather pay between $24,000 and $46,000 to go to UF to be taught solely by those who are hired based on skill and intelligence, or nearly double to go to Harvard and really have absolutely no idea whether your professor is actually worthy of their position? That's an easy choice for me. The Supreme Court already abolished affirmative action for students applying to college, and it only makes sense. This is taken a step further to impact the faculty. Now, I applaud the University of Florida for taking the measures to ensure their students get the best possible experience and also guarantee that the best of the best, la creme de la creme, are being rewarded with coveted teaching positions. It helps absolutely nobody in the long run when DEI overtakes merit. I mean, you want the best example I can give you? Look no further than Claudine Gay, the former president of Harvard, who was revealed for being a massive fraud, not only for her inability to denounce anti-Semitism, but also for being exposed for plagiarism on several different occasions. Do you actually believe that is who Harvard actually thought was the best person for the job when she was hired? Or did she check some boxes? Now Harvard's reputation is forever tarnished. And I would say good on Florida for being brave and sending DEI to die. Now students can get back to focusing on what really matters, that being their education. And now on that note, let's bring in someone else who is just, well, I would say preaching more of the things that we need to hear as a country. Someone who really represents the youngest generation to the fullest. Her name is Isabel Brown. She's a Turning Point contributor and an author of a upcoming book being released, I believe, on March 19th, called The End of the Alphabet, How Gen Z Can Save America. Isabel, I'm so happy to have you on the show. I've been admiring you from afar for a while now, so it's finally good to finally get to have a conversation with you.
Absolutely. Good morning, and thank you so much for having me.
So you probably heard me just get into it. University of Florida doing away with DEI. Thank goodness, right? I feel like college students, that's the last thing that they need to be involved with. They're there to get an education, and in so many instances, they're not able to focus on the reasons why they're there, because they're forced to also live with the insufferable notions of DEI that's being forced upon them. So what do you think about the University of Florida going in this direction and going in it very quickly?
You know, it's been interesting the last several years watching states like California or even Colorado, where I grew up and attended university at Colorado State University, typically a pretty conservative agriculture-based school, leading the race to the bottom in the United States of America for what the new cultural low would look like in terms of Generation Z's lifestyle and values that we bring with us after graduation day into the halls of Congress, into corporate boardrooms, onto our social media feeds, and everywhere in between. But having moved to Florida myself in this last year, I'm really seeing Florida lead the race for a blueprint for a stronger America moving forward. And this new DEI ruling at the University of Florida, and you saw Governor Ron DeSantis's tweet there saying Florida is where DEI goes to die, is just the latest example of that. We're trying to revive a quality education and a path forward to concrete success for Generation Z that, frankly, most higher ed opportunities in America just don't really offer anymore, whether that be Harvard or your local state school right around the corner.
Mm-hmm. So, Isabel, what year did you graduate from Colorado State?
I graduated from undergrad in 2019 and graduate school from Georgetown in Washington, D.C. In 2020. And, you know, DEI was still a relatively new term at the time. Things were just coming onto the scene in terms of banned words and phrases on campus, like the word America at my university, because it might be offensive to somebody who doesn't identify
Wait, stop right there. Which university was America deemed to be offensive at? Was it Colorado State or Georgetown?
Colorado State, of all places, believe it or not, from our administration.
Oh,
and they never asked students how we felt about this, but had to tell us we should be offended by that word. I knew maybe one person on campus at the time who identified with they, them pronouns, and that was a brand new idea. So if you think about that, that's really all happened in the last 5 years or so that we've seen this spiral completely out of control. And it's time we retake educational institutions for just that, education again.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I graduated from college several years ago. I mean, before DEI was even something that was even being floated as an idea. And I don't recall any of this. And I went to a very liberal university. I went to American University in Washington, D.C., not so far from Georgetown. And I was not confronted with any of this. Like, I was able to live my life. I was able to say what I wanted. And that was still a time when things were still getting by that now, I mean, might actually be considered offensive in some senses, and no one was talking about any of this. So I'm actually very thankful I attended university when I did, because I can't even imagine how I would react if I had to deal with so many of the things that college students are dealing with today, many of them being of the Gen Z generation, which you're very in touch with. That's all the basis of your upcoming book. Talking about the election coming up, Gen Z, a very important voter base for the candidates. How do the Republicans, the Democrats, I mean, what's going to be each of their strategies to try to win over these voting bases?
Such an important question, and I'm glad one that we're asking, or at least starting to ask as we get a little bit closer to November, because for whatever reason, Generation Z has been written off, at least by the political right, for many years as entitled, lazy, socialist, automatically going to vote with the Democrat Party. And the data tells us exactly the opposite. At least culturally, Gen Z is the most conservative generation America has seen since World War II. There is ample evidence for that. And I wish we had 3 hours on your program to go through all of it today. But we're deleting our dating apps in droves. We're quitting hormonal birth control. 93% of us still want to get married at a time where we have the lowest marriage rate in American history. We're quitting stupid four-year university degrees that really aren't going to lead to success, especially if we have to spend $250,000 for a degree in, I don't know, underwater non-binary dance theory, right? I mean, it's not going to actually lead anything positive to our lives.
Is that a real career track now? Because I feel like it would be.
I wouldn't be surprised if it is, sadly. That's the direction we're going in America. But we believe that politics is downstream from culture. And we say this all the time in the culture war of the American right, but that's starting to come to fruition for Gen Z as well. You know, 52% of newly registered voters, especially just now graduating from college or even high school, are registering as independents in America today. We are not pledging blind allegiance to one party or another. but we really have lacked a strategy from the right with how to reach Generation Z. The left has been very, very skilled at this for the last several election cycles, using armies of influencers on TikTok, trying to convince you that your life was on the ballot, which worked incredibly well in 2022. And luckily, thanks to really outspoken voices like Vivek Ramaswamy and even many people on Donald Trump's campaign team, there's a lot of voices starting to realize the importance of social media and connecting on those cultural issues to then bring about political change with Generation Z.
Yeah, I mean, you're someone else that we should include as a tool to reach some of those younger voters that the Republican Party really desperately needs at this point. What's your message to the rest of Gen Z when you say, listen, you guys need to be paying attention about these ideas and these issues that maybe they are trying to turn a blind eye to at this point because of tactics used by the liberal media and also the party?
I think it's really powerful when we take a second to just strip away political labels and all of the partisan division today and just acknowledge where we're at in 2024 America. A lot of people much older than myself with talking heads on TV or radio hosts or even podcasts I'm fortunate to appear on often say that Gen Z is destroying America, right? This is the end of life as we know it, which is why I called my book The End of the Alphabet as a fun nod to that. But if we really look at the end of life as we know it, let's assess what life as we know it is. If it means rampant division to the point that I can't even have a conversation with my classmate on my college campus because of these DEI initiatives, I'm all for the end of life as we know it. If life as we know it means cutting off the genitals of a child and trying to call that progress or love or acceptance, I am all for the end of life as we know it. If it means telling women that they cannot be single mothers or be empowered to embrace life for their child because the only thing that they should be putting at the top of their priority list is climbing a corporate ladder for a woke CEO in New York or San Francisco, I think most people in our generation would say we are proud to fight for the end of life as we know it. But, you know, this goes back to the beginning of our country. And I think a lot of people forget about this. Our founding fathers were not these decrepit, old, geriatric, ancient, sagging at the seams people who weren't fighting for a better future. They were 18, 19, 20, 21 years old on July 4th, 1776. So it seems like a radical idea for young people to take back the driver's seat of American culture and fight for objective truth again. But our country has always depended on it, even before we were the United States of America.
So fighting for the end of the world as we know it, based on the examples you gave, I'm also all for ending the world and fighting for it to end as we know it. Are you seeing a shift within Gen Z? I know that they have more of a mind of their own than people give them credit for. I will say even there have been times when I've been guilty at kind of pointing the finger and say, why are you doing this? You know, you don't understand this. But are you seeing a shift as more messaging is coming out? And listen, social media is unfortunate because a lot of the conservative messaging does get suppressed and censored. But some of it is tending to slip through the cracks now more and more. And I have to imagine people are able to start paying a little bit more attention.
We are. Yeah. And, social media, it's a 12-hour long PhD level dissertation conversation to have. But even in spite of this algorithm transparency problem that I think everybody really wants an answer to, social media is just a tool. It can be used for really, really good or really, really bad. And I think we've seen both sides of the coin really come out into play with this culture war over the last several years. But social media has opened opportunities for dialogue, for challenge of perspective, and for telling objective truth in a time where our mainstream media is refusing to do that far more often than not. And I think directly can contribute to this cultural shift that we're seeing with Generation Z. I shared a few examples with you earlier, but culturally, we really are reclaiming these traditional values in a new age way. And we're doing that alongside the vehicle of entrepreneurship, of content creation, even if we have a full-time job somewhere else, to share better ideas and stronger values with others on social media. And there's this excitement and revitalization for reclaiming the American dream as we continue to come into adulthood that I have no doubt will continue to pass on to generations to come.
Mm-hmm. Well, talking about a dream, it was interesting because over the weekend, there was a New York Times columnist who wrote an op-ed about a dream that they had about Biden stepping aside and announcing that he's not running in 2024. To hear this come from someone from the New York Times is pretty remarkable, right? You wouldn't normally imagine that such a liberal media source would print something that explains them having ideas going in the direction of Biden not being the candidate. Although that is becoming, I think, more of a mainstream idea, realizing we already talked about the geriatric folks that are running the show right now. I know that Gen Z isn't necessarily shifting to the right in all senses, but is there more of a feeling that a lot of people are starting to fully understand, Gen Z fully understand that no matter what direction the Democratic Party goes in, it really can't be with Joe Biden?
Tons of polling and data and surveys are starting to prove that very fact. It's actually quite exciting to see. You'd expect young people to be overwhelmingly in favor of the Democrat Party just a few months before an election, and we certainly saw that in 2020. But recent polling suggests that Gen Z is overwhelmingly swinging the pendulum back to the right because of the complete incompetence of President Joe Biden. And you could attribute that to a million different reasons, maybe one of which is the fact that he's been in Washington, D.C. longer than twice the time all of us have been alive, and it shows. But I do think that we're in for a bit of a shakeup as we get closer to the DNC in August. There's a lot of chatter happening inside the Beltway that Joe Biden will not be the nominee for the Democrat Party. And many of us have been predicting this for a long time. Truthfully, with Gen Z and millennials together being the largest voter demographic going into 2024 for the first time ever, it really would be in the best interest of the Democrats to replace their current nominee.
Yeah, although who they replace him with, also a bit of a scary thought. But that's something we won't get into at this moment in time. Isabel, I want to get back to the notion of Gen Z starting to really make some shifts within their daily lives. You talked about getting off birth control, wanting to have families, like getting back to these traditional values. Something that we've seen, it's not just affecting Gen Z, the millennial group as well, consume them really, is the idea of these dating apps, you know, just constantly swiping, trying to find their perfect match on the internet, using AI-based tools to help them along their journey rather than, you know, meeting someone the traditional way through mutual friends out in the real world. Well, now there is a class action lawsuit being filed against dating apps claiming that these platforms like Hinge and Tinder, for example, are actually more so just addictive than helpful. What's your take just overall on dating apps and the state that it's put, I guess, the state of relationships in for these younger generations?
I'm a bit of an old soul, so I feel incredibly odd one out every once in a while when I have announced to my friends that I've never downloaded a dating app. I've just never seen the appeal or the interest.
You.
And I was very fortunate to meet my fiance the old fashioned way randomly at a work conference. But I do understand why so many people in our generation feel the need to download these platforms as their only lifeline to finding long-term commitment and love. Because we've been told from every pillar of society, our favorite influencers, celebrities, even our parents, that it's just impossible to meet somebody at church, at a bar, at a work conference, the old-fashioned way, that nobody connects or hangs out in the real world anymore, especially post-COVID, where everything has been happening through a screen. But interestingly, even though everyone is using these to a rampant en masse scale, we're really disappointed with the results that they've yielded for our generation. Over 90% of us, according to a recent survey, said that we've had horrible experiences on dating apps, and more than a quarter of Gen Zers who've downloaded a dating app with the intention of finding somebody have deleted it within the month because they've realized that it's not actually leading to anything concrete or positive or a solid foundation of love. It's an app that's designed to turn them into a serial customer because that's where these companies stand to financially benefit, keeping you swiping instead of being designed to be deleted. So I'm not surprised that one of these lawsuits has finally come to fruition, but it's really just common sense from a business perspective that these companies have no vested interest whatsoever in helping you get off the app. They want to keep you on forever.
Yeah, and it is interesting because I think the tagline for Hinge specifically is designed to be deleted. And just as some, I mean, I'm not on any dating apps at this point in time, but years ago, probably when they were, I guess, maybe a little bit fresher and newer to the landscape, I just remember swiping and getting some matches, and it felt more of like a game than anything else. You're like, ooh, I matched with someone. It wasn't necessarily that you saw a long-term future, but it was just exciting. It was like, you know, you win the lottery. It's like a little mini lottery that you win every now and again when you get these matches. And I just recall talking to these people. And like you said, it would go nowhere. It was just a directionless conversation. We would ultimately just fall off. And I'm like, well, there's some wasted time. It didn't amount to much of anything. But I'm also curious because I know that I'm all for organic meetings. And I'm so happy to hear you met your fiance in that same manner. That's the best way to meet somebody. But does Gen Z have a tendency now? Because I don't see them spending their time the same way even that I saw the millennial group spending their time. It seems like they don't like going out as much and they don't like spending their times in these social settings like the older generations did as much. So where would they, in essence, meet somebody if it's not on apps?
I get this question all the time from my younger cohort of followers. Well, where can I please go find a place to meet somebody? You know, I don't know that it's as much the fault of Gen Z refusing to interact with each other as it is the world has just fundamentally changed since 2020, where everything is happening through Zoom and through a screen. Our jobs, our school, our entertainment, and even our relationships have all been fostered in this two-dimensional sense that I think there's this really strong resurgence and hunger for in-person connection again, whatever that looks like. Obviously, we've seen that on the educational side of things with people refusing to do Zoom University and pay the same amount of money as an in-person experience, but it's becoming true for friendships and dating as well. So I've heard countless success stories of people meeting at political conferences, at church youth groups, even just asking your friends to introduce you to somebody. And I think that is on the upswing in terms of Generation Z's hunger for real, authentic in-person connection again.
Before I let you go, just because you mentioned the pandemic really putting a damper on people's ability to meet each other, because it did truly change the way that we interact. You were in grad school during the pandemic when it hit, right? You said you were at Georgetown in 2020. What was the experience like for you attending college during the pandemic when everything was so two-dimensional?
Honestly, I'm still trying to process a whole lot of it, especially because I was studying biomedical sciences, policy, and advocacy. So essentially public health law, and was learning from some of the top people at the WHO and the CDC in class one day and hearing them say something dramatically different on national television or in a press conference with the president the next. Obviously, all of this started unfolding through a screen. I graduated through Zoom, which was incredibly disappointing, although not as much as my younger sister graduating from high school virtually. And, you know, just still has created this total vacuum of knowledge and hunger for objective truth in the scientific community, which is why I do what I do today as a creator. I was pre-med in college. I never thought that I would do this for a career. But like any good scientist, I've always been hungry for that pursuit of objective truth, of real research, of asking all of the tough questions. And I think there's a lot of reason to have hope with more Americans waking up to that reality every single day, even if we're not seeing it in academia.
Okay, I lied. I have another question because you just intrigued me. Wait, you were pre-med in college?
I sure was, yes.
Okay, so where did the career transition take place? How did it take place?
Honestly, I attribute 100% of this to God. I never could have predicted that my life would look the way that it did. But as I found myself sitting in classes like physiology or human gross anatomy or even the dreaded organic chemistry, which, yes, I had to take 3 times. I'm not ashamed of admitting that. I was not really learning about the pursuit of objective truth. I was truly learning about my professor's opinion on a border wall or the evil orange guy that these horrible middle-aged white supremacists had elected into the Oval Office. Of course, my professors not knowing that I had cast my vote for the same individual sitting in class during their rants, and was incredibly fortunate to have this spark for dialogue and intellectual diversity on my campus when I was a college student. So I did what I could in bringing some speakers to campus. Candace Owens' first ever speaking event on a college campus was when I was a student at CSU. We had Dennis Prager come to campus. Later on, Donald Trump Jr. and several others came after I graduated. But it was a really exciting time, and I fell in love with conversations and looking for that objective truth in society again and knew that I had to take it with me after graduation. So like any good student, sat my parents down and said, I'm going to start posting videos on the internet instead of attending medical school. And it's been a wonderful journey since then in the last 5 years, truly beyond my wildest expectations and the possibilities of impact we could have for Generation Z.
Well, yeah, and your impact has only just begun. You're about to release your book, like we mentioned, dropping March 19th, I saw. So tell us a little bit about the book and where people can grab a copy.
The book is absolutely for all audiences, although it serves two different purposes. First, to just expose older generations to the truth about Gen Z. We have been written off as this hopeless, doomed generation destroying society, but we might be America's last saving grace. And more importantly, as a rallying cry for members of our own generation, that we don't have to wait for permission to have enough age or life experience to embrace leadership and to reclaim these traditional values for ourselves. We're already on that path. And if we're serious about saving Western civilization, that responsibility is going to fall on us to do just that. You can buy at the end of the alphabet anywhere that books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or anywhere else that you can imagine. And thank you so much in advance for picking up a copy and bringing some hope back to our generation and those to come after us.
Incredible. Well, I cannot wait to get my copy. Isabel, you are so lovely and you're so intelligent. And I'm so happy to have finally had a chance to speak with you. So thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Outkick the Morning will be right back after a short break. Stay tuned.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Okay. Oh my gosh, she's so smart. She's so beautiful. Wow. We need more young women like Isabel Brown. Okay, so moving on to the weekend that was for yours truly. There was another Fight Night weekend in the books. I was out in Las Vegas, but no one prepared your girl or these girls for the insane weather this weekend.
Las Vegas! Drivers, start your engines!
Okay, so obviously you could see their headpieces were going crazy, flying all over the place. Winds were up to 70 miles per hour this weekend. I have never been to Las Vegas and experienced weather like this, let me tell you. You could barely walk outside. There was at one point I was sitting doing some work in a cafe in the hotel, and I was sitting in front of some double doors. And the amount of people that I watched attempt to walk outside and walk right back in, at least 50. The glass doors to my hotel, not the ones I was sitting nearby, thank goodness, they actually shattered as a result of the high winds. Good news, Fight Night took place inside where I was safe from all of the elements inside the UFC Apex. Not so safe, though, the guys inside the Octagon. Now, it was quite the scene. Here I am standing on the Octagon delivering a report. That's what I do during fight night. I have several of these over the course of the broadcast. And luckily, nothing was taking place inside the cage at this point. But when we got to the main event, it was a heavyweight showdown. We had a guy who's only competing in his second fight in the UFC up to this point, Shamil Gaziev. And then on the other side from him, Jarzynia Rozenstrike, someone who has a wealth of experience in the UFC. This was actually his sixth main event, which is the most of any, even out of any UFC champion, excluding John Jones. So this guy, Jarzynia, the one throwing the punch right there, he definitely more the experience of the two, and he's the one who came away with the victory. In fact, it happened because the ref called a stoppage at the end of the third round. In between rounds, Shamil had said something to his camp. Now, he speaks in Russian, so the ref couldn't understand what he was saying. But he knew something was off. So he demanded that Shamil's guys fill him in on what was happening. And he said, if you want to do the right thing, tell me what he said. Finally, someone stepped up and they said he can't see out of one eye, which obviously, as you can imagine, a big problem when you're fighting. So the fight was called right then and there. Rozenstruik declared the winner by TKO stoppage and just another notch in his belt in the heavyweight division. Something else noteworthy that happened over the course of the night, Tyson Pedro, someone who has a career record, 10-5 overall, he announced his retirement after his fight. This was me interviewing him after weigh-ins. He's definitely a crowd favorite. He's a guy from Sydney, Australia, really gem of a human being. And he had a pretty disappointing performance against Vitor Petrino. Excuse me, my accent is off this morning. But at the end of the fight, he came forward. He said, I didn't want to steal the spotlight from my opponent, who obviously had his time on the mic sharing his thoughts with Daniel Cormier afterwards. But Tyson Pedro came forward and said, I have other things I need to look forward to in my life. I've got a daughter. I want to focus more attention on her. And he laid his gloves down on the octagon floor, took them off, and said his farewell. So it was definitely a noteworthy fight night. A lot of fun across the board. I'll be back in 2 weeks for another one. I feel like I am always in Vegas, but cross your fingers, the wind dies down, because that was way too much for me. I'd like to walk into the hotel with the doors intact. That's my goal. Everybody, thank you so much for being here. It was such a wonderful show. Thank you again to Isabel Brown for taking the time to come on the show. And we've got another program dropping tomorrow morning. In the meantime, you can find me all over social media across all platforms at Charlie on TV. So again, thank you for being here, and I will see you tomorrow.